Hey, everybody. My conversation with Alex Marlowe, breaking the news, and we also take questions straight from the audience, live from Turning Point USA's headquarters. You're going to love this conversation. Alex Marlowe is the editor-in-chief of Breitbart News. Email us your thoughts, freedom@charliekirk.com. And if you want to support this program, go to charliekirk.com/support. Thank you for supporting us so generously. Buckle up, everybody. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Hey, everybody. How are we doing? Great to see all of you. And Alex, welcome to Turning Point.
I'm thrilled to be here, Charlie. A beautiful setup you have here. So impressive. Congratulations to everyone who's a part
of it. Thank you. Well, the team worked very hard on this, and everyone who's watching online has to get their copy of Alex's new book, Breaking the News, and you all get a chance to have Alex sign it. It's terrific. Congratulations.
Thank you. New York Times bestseller, which I'm
sure...
Is that
official now today?
Yeah, as of last week. But that was I would have loved him in a fly on the wall in the room there in New York Times.
Do we
have to put the Breitbart guy on here? He sold so many of these books, but we hate that guy. There's literally a whole chapter in the book about how horrible the New York Times is. So that is a thrill. I don't need their approval, as you know. You don't need their approval either. But it is fun to troll them with an entire book.
What number on the list were you?
13, which is a good 9 or 10 lower than I would have got if they just went off of sales.
And it's this awful formula that they use.
Yeah, the formula is if you're a conservative.
That exactly right.
You don't get on.
That's right.
Unless you sell 1 bajillion copies. But luckily, thanks to all of you great people, I guess I sold enough. But that's good.
You did very well, and it's hard to write a book. What's amazing about this book, and you'll enjoy it, is the research that went into it. There's actually breaking news within this book. And I want to talk about this and kind of see where it leads us, Alex. But sure. There was some big news that you kind of teased the world with. I'll never forget. I was at an event in Palm Beach, and one of our board members comes up to me. I think I told you the story. And he says, Charlie, listening to Alex Marlowe, and he said that there's a new George Soros. Who is it? I said, Alex won't even tell me who it is. Well, now we know who it is.
Yeah.
Who is the new George Soros?
It's a woman named Lorene Powell Jobs, and she could pronounce it Lauren, but I don't care. It's spelled Lorene, and there's a reason why we don't know how to even pronounce her name. It's because she's operating in the shadows, even though she's one of the most powerful people in American culture. She's a dominant force in American culture, and this is utterly serious. And it's always kind of somewhat fun to when a new villain announces themselves in conservative America. But it is not a joke what she's doing. Not a joke, as our current president might say, what she's doing. Come on, folks. They were already in a malarkey mode. We've been here for 30 seconds. So here's what she's done. She inherited all of her wealth from her late husband, Steve Jobs, who was a bona fide American success story and genius. Invented Apple, and then he took a hiatus from Apple and invented Pixar, which people sometimes don't forget. That's like the second line on his epitaph is the biggest animation studio, which makes pretty great movies. A lot of family friendly movies, by the way.
It used to be good. Now
used to be fair enough.
A bunch
fair
of
enough.
Garbage.
Fair enough. But that's bad news because I have kids now. So it was when all the cartoons were good, I was in my 20s. So she inherited something like $10 billion. Maybe it's 20. We don't really know. It's part of the pattern you're going to see. And she sets up this trust for herself. And the trust includes something she calls the Emerson Collective, named after Ralph Waldo Emerson. And with this, she staffs it, this huge organization, sprawling financial philanthropy / investing. If that sounds confusing, that's the point. This is the whole point. And what she does there is she buys up these media outlets. The biggest name is probably The Atlantic. You guys might recall The Atlantic. They were the ones who pushed that suckers and losers lie. Do you remember that? This is the single fakest news of the 2020 election was the lie The Atlantic pushed that Trump had called dead troops suckers and losers. Do you guys recall that one? Unbelievably bad. And we wrote about it extensively at the time at Breitbart. And Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor-in-chief, wrote the story not with any caveats, not reporting, not allegedly. It was written as a fact. Trump said that. And his evidence was 4 anonymous sources. Okay, not a single person on record. And we at Breitbart tracked down maybe 10 on record sources, at least 8 or 9, who said flat out, I will sign my name to it. This never happened. And of those people, some of them were Trump haters. John Bolton, John Kelly, people did not want Trump to succeed, still said that's a bridge too far. He didn't call, you know, dead Americans who sacrificed their life for this great country. He didn't call them suckers and losers. And what's more, Trump refused to go to a cemetery to honor them, allegedly, because it was going to mess up his coif, his hair. This was sold to the public by the head of the Atlantic. What's not mentioned that much about this story, it was actually about a year and a half old. And it was timed specifically about a month before the election, when Trump was actually having a good news cycle. Job numbers were coming in. We were really seeing the results of the Abraham Accords. We were seeing the Middle East in the most peaceful place in my entire lifetime. And at this specific moment, they launched this attack on Trump, totally fake. And then we need to spend 4 days debunking it. And in the eyes of some people, it was never debunked completely because they don't read any outlet that's going to push back on the story. So, and the cascade of what happened when the story came out, it comes out at night, good news cycle for Trump. The following morning, the Democrats already have an ad that is cut that plays on Morning Joe, slamming Trump for calling troops suckers and losers. Obama repeated it all the way up to Election Day. So this was used to attack Trump over and over again to distract the public from what's going on in this country. And then that afternoon, Biden team has a press conference. Who gets the first question? The Atlantic gets the first question. Imagine that. They get the first question just like that. And what do they ask? They ask for the Biden team to evaluate Trump's soul. How could Trump, look into Trump's soul? How could a man say that our dead troops are suckers and losers? It's the sanctimoniousness, of course, makes you want to retch. But it is distracting the world from good news that Trump had going, not to mention there's huge vaccine progress by that point. And now what are we talking about? We're talking about a fake story from 2018. All came from The Atlantic. That's just one of Lorene Powell Jobs' outlets. She also has Axios, another one which poses as sort of a credible Beltway blog of some sort, insider Beltway stuff. But there's always a subtext, and that subtext is big corporations good and orange man bad. I mean, that's sort of the subtext of what a lot of Axios is all about. And they got a lot of scoops because they had, I guess, convinced some people that they were more neutral than they are. But they were weaponized, I believe, against Trump. And I think that the reporting bears it out. What's really interesting is these outlets all report on each other, and they rarely ever disclose it. And I looked at like a dozen examples of Axios reporting on other Lorene Powell Jobs publications, and like half the time they mention it, and then half the time they don't. It's very odd. There's no pattern because there's no standards in journalism at this time, which is another one of the themes of the books. We've thrown out everything that's remotely close to a journalistic standard. But then she funds the left-wing media, ProPublica, Mother Jones. You guys have probably heard of these places. They're left-wing, but they do some good work, but they are activist. But then she funds this thing called Acronym, and Acronym controls something called the Courier Newsroom. The Courier Newsroom is one of the most repulsive things in American journalism right now. It is literal propaganda, and it is gussied up to look like real news stories that go into local news outlets and on Facebook in particular, and it is designed to mislead. It is literal fake news. It is Democrat talking points laundered through what appears to be local news. It's not, but it appears to be local news to confuse people and to think these Democrat talking points are actually real life. They're not real life. They're fake. And she does all this stuff. In the meantime, all of these outlets. Oh, now this. I forgot one of my favorites, which is
And that's the one most young people hear.
Yes.
Students. Now. You guys see Now This on Snapchat or Facebook. The Now This stuff. They have a whole embed. It's all funded by Lorene Powell Jobs.
It's a Lorene Powell Jobs joint. That's what we call it in the Breitbart headquarters these days. So, and that's a millennial focus, viral. But they all push the same candidates, often at the same times. They all push the same heroes and villains all at the same time. And there's one woman at the top, $20 billion, anonymous, making this massive influence and information play, because you can use these outlets to investigate your opponents too. But she's making this huge influence play. No one knows who she is. No one knows. Did you guys know her name? Any of you? Raise your hands if you'd heard of Lorene Powell Jobs before the book. I'm getting about 4 out of 200. Okay. So there's the math. So 2%. And this is from a super informed audience. So this is what she's doing this. And then you read these articles about Kamala Harris, who's her close personal friend. Kamala Harris, close personal friend. Kamala Harris got no delegates, I think. Can someone look that up? I should look this up. How many delegates? She ran for president for 10 months. How many delegates did she get? I think zero. So she was an insanely unlikable candidate. She ends up as vice president. Okay. Odd. A little odd. Someone so wildly unpopular. Well, could it have been returning a favor for some people? I'm not saying just Lorraine Powell Jobs. I'm not saying that she handpicked the vice president. I'm just saying that this is how party politics works. But now party politics isn't just party politics. It's media politics. It is the establishment media that is now directly connected to the Democrats. And this will be what we talk about, I'm sure, throughout the next hour and beyond, because we're going to do Q&A. And that's not a trust the plan code. Okay. When I say Q&A, I'm talking about questions. You got to be careful these days.
You never know, Alex. And so what you really uncovered here is this idea, I think, you pulled back what I think is so important of this idea of consent to the governed. We're being governed by people we didn't vote for, that we don't know who they are. We'd have no way to really check and balance them. So the American system is the greatest system ever created, especially when you talk about massive amounts of land and different types of people and different religions. It's a really unprecedented experiment. And yes, one of the reasons it's worked is because there's always been a check and a balance, an independent judiciary. We have to give you permission to do something very big and dramatic and bold. And really what Alex uncovered here is arguably the most important thing. You can make an argument there's more important things, but really if you control the lines of communication, you can control almost everything else. It's not just functioning incorrectly, it's now rigged against that American system, where you now have a $20 billion woman who most people don't even know who she exists. And I even got the guess wrong. I tried to get this out of Alex. I got to say, this guy is the most disciplined author I've ever dealt with. I must have texted him, like, who is it, Alex? Who is the new George Soros? Nope, wouldn't tell me. That she is now really able to kind of call shots.
Yes.
In what information you are able to understand. I want to just reinforce one other point. Axios, Atlantic, do you know what else they also have very close relationships with? Apple News. How many of you guys get Apple News Absolutely. Notifications?
I can't turn it off. Maybe one of you young people can help me. I can't turn it off.
Let's think. Now, why would Lorraine Powell Jobs have a relationship with Apple News? Huh. That one's beyond me, Alex.
Okay, so now let's add something else, which is even if you can get past, and I'm not saying you can, but even if you can get past that she is funding the candidates and the outlets that are supposed to cover those candidates. And not to mention she's made, I think I counted 700 donations to Democrats over the last six to seven years.
Tens of millions.
She loves Democrats. So she's funding the Democrats and the outlets that are supposed to cover them. But where's she making her money? Does Apple only make money in the United States of America? Pretty sure they make a lot of money in China. How about Disney? Pixar is Disney now, right? So
just so you guys know, she's the second largest shareholder in Disney.
Second. Okay. So do you think that any of these outlets are going to, I don't know, seek out the origins of the coronavirus pandemic that was unleashed on this country? Do you think they're going to show any remote interest in that? At best case scenario, they ignore it. Worst case scenario, when they see a narrative that makes Trump the bad guy and China neutral, maybe they did good. Maybe China even beat the pandemic and we accept their propaganda talking points that they haven't had a death since May of last year. Maybe they just accept that, as is the case with outlets like Bloomberg and other places. They're just flat out, New York Times did it too. They beat it. China beat the pandemic. How do they know? They haven't been over to Wuhan. It's the they know because everyone around them is telling them, don't mess up the business with China. And as far as I know, this is the thing that I hate the most about the book. Almost everything I uncover is at this time legal. What Lorraine Powell Jobs does is legal. I cannot find one illegal thing that she is doing. I'm not saying that she isn't doing something illegal, but this to me is why the Republicans need to get focused too. That's right. And you cannot give away seats. You cannot give away opportunities. And they need to be working hard right now. This is not a time to take off. This is a time to do what the Democrats did after 2016, which is they made protesting the new brunch. Instead of going to brunch on Sundays, they would protest Trump. What were they protesting? I don't know. He woke up on the wrong side of the bed. Or he tied his shoes wrong. He had, you know, slid down a ramp or something. Let's protest. It doesn't matter. They were engaged. And I'm not sensing that 100% from the right now.
And I want to actually pick that apart because I totally agree. And you know, I really want to talk about where the conservative movement is going. I'm less interested in Republican versus Democrat of any time in my life. I don't know if you guys feel the same.
Yeah, I do.
And we at Turning Point are obviously a nonprofit, so we focus strictly on education and culture. And I actually think that's what matters most. I think that they're going to take the orders from citizens that actually understand why we're here, how this system's supposed to work, more so than just Republicans good and Democrats bad, because I think we can see in states like this that it doesn't always matter what party you're affiliated with. Anyway.
Yeah, and I also think to that point, there's a lot of people who are in the independent left who agree with almost everything I've said so far. It's they still want Democrats to win more than Republicans, I think, in the end. But they're very concerned about the corporate and China influence over American news at the moment.
I agree. And I'm waiting for them to actually say that. They might think that, but vocalizing it would be something else. So, Alex, I grew up in a conservative movement where there was a book written by a certain New Yorker reporter called Dark Money. And they were really worried about corporate influence and rich people having too much sort of sway over American politics. Remember the demonization of the Koch brothers and all of that. What you're articulating here is far more sophisticated, way more ambitious, not even close to trying to pander, and quite honestly, in some way, bizarrely ideological. It's almost like, what is her agenda? It might be to keep the Chinese interests, but it's almost as if I don't care if I lose money as long as more people believe what I want them to believe.
You've identified one of the main themes that comes through throughout the book is for these newsrooms, they're all part of these conglomerates that are so big that the goal is not to make money. The goal is to protect the bigger interests of the corporations that they're a part of. If NBC News takes a little hit, who cares? NBC is part of NBC, Comcast, Universal. So long as they're not messing up the business interests in China, is that's one major newsroom that is not going to look deep into China, then Universal Pictures, which opens up Fast and Furious, coming, right? John Cena? Isn't it weird now how we're in this age where the most muscle-bound guys are the biggest weenies?
That's so true.
It's so odd. He does nothing but lift iron over his head for a living, get hit over the head with a folding chair. And he's the biggest weenus. What a weakling. I mean, I could just play that video on a loop.
I don't know if you guys saw that, but he said something. I think he called Taiwan. It's
a country, which it is.
I think it was even less. He said they were like a people or anything. You're probably right. It was so vanilla. And he went on this long apology in Mandarin saying, how dare I call Taiwan a country?
Yeah.
And if you know your Chinese politics, you're not allowed to even say anything slightly positive about Taiwan. By the way, that's going to be the new frontier is Taiwanese sovereignty. That's going to be a huge issue, but that's a different issue for different.
And John is so brave, so brave. Just immediately bend over for the Chinese. Unbelievable.
But Alex, I want you to unpack this, how the journalists of our country, the profit motive and the desire to be famous motive.
Yeah.
Used to drive really good journalism in our country. So it used to be newsrooms that were like, you know what? I want to get the story before the Washington Post. I want to get the story before the New York Times. I want to get the story before ABC News. I want to get the story before NBC News. And we actually saw some form, and you've all seen the movie, All the President's Men, when Woodward and Bernstein and Woodward, they still go on television. They haven't done an honest slick of anything for the country since Nixon, and they've just rode that forever, right? Where they believed what some would have considered a conspiracy theory at the time, and all the institutional papers were like, you know what, we're not going to run this story.
Sure.
And the Washington Post, I believe it was the Washington Post, was actually a little bit more of a fledgling paper at the time. They were not a top-tier paper, but they're like, you know what, if we stand by our reporters and we're right, we will now be a top-tier paper, and it changed their subscriber base forever. What you're saying, Alex, is they're no longer driven by the grittiness of Woodward and Bernstein. They're now driven by an ideological agenda.
They are, absolutely. And the decisions in terms of what's the best for the bottom line are not just taking place with these people you see popping up on Twitter and on cable news. They're the boardrooms. And the boardrooms are going to make sure the interests are protected. CNN is part of AT&T, Time Warner. You know, you've got, I mentioned ABC and NBC and all of these places, just huge conglomerates that are part of it. The Atlantic is one small piece of Lorene Powell Jobs' portfolio. But to your point, Charlie, this is where at Breitbart, we got our start with two major stories, and both of them the media told us we could not report. The first was the Acorn Scoop with James O'Keefe. That many of you guys probably remember it. And if you don't, you should look it up, and you should read Andrew Breitbart's book, by the way. You can read mine first, just for now. And then his book, Righteous Indignation, which is a must read and a little shorter than mine. So you can get through that one quick. But a brilliant book, and he breaks it down what he did. But James O'Keefe comes into Andrew's office, and I was just junior assistant at the time, literally working in Andrew's basement. And he says, I've got these tapes of this group, Acorn, the Association for Community Organizing and Reform Now. And I went around and impersonated a prostitute and a pimp. James O'Keefe was the pimp. This woman named Hannah Giles was the prostitute. And Acorn, in every case but one, would help them launder money to start a child sex trafficking business in order to, on film, he had a button camera in his button, in order to pad the campaign coffers for James's alleged budding political career. Every Acorn office but one. Acorn gets a lot of government funding, and they were going to be linked to the census. This is right before 2010. They were going to be in charge of taking the census in certain areas. And when the story came out, everyone said it was fake news, that it's not true. And Andrew Breitbart was a liar, and Andrew Breitbart was deceptively editing the tapes, and James O'Keefe wasn't a real journalist. And when the dust settled, Andrew and James, of course, had the last laugh. But even people in Andrew's corner, even Andrew's friends, were doubting his strategy. And what he did is he originated the drip, drip, drip method, where you first bait the media by putting out one piece of evidence, and then the media will announce the evidence is fake, and then you drop the second piece of evidence. And then they say, well, that's fake too, and then the third piece. And then it goes on, and they all humiliate themselves. And it was unbelievable to watch it play out in real time, which I got to do. The next one was the Anthony Weiner story, which was just the thrill of a lifetime for me to be a part of this. I mean, the story was unbelievable, and Weiner really hurt himself. And I forget if I wrote about this in the book. I think I touch on it briefly, but this was my first time that I really had a major say in one of our major decisions, because Weiner had tweeted a picture of his, right, and just unbelievably fortunate for those of us who like the theater of politics. But the trick is that we'd never done a sex scandal before Breitbart, and we still haven't. We don't intend to do them. But he had said that he had been hacked. And then we had a hacking story. So we just got the report. Let's just report he says he was hacked, and we'll go with the hacking angle, which was my suggestion, which Andrew took. And the whole time we were told they were fake stories. Maybe even Breitbart was the hacker. Maybe we're the hacker. Maybe we should be investigated. Of course not. It was just a reckless guy who's a perv, who doing what reckless pervs do online, which is tweet pictures of their junk they're not supposed to the wrong people. I mean, we've seen it time and again since. But well, at the time, it was pretty novel.
So I remember when this was actually one of the first things I ever was really paying attention to in politics. And Alex, I think it happened at a weird hour at night, and Andrew just so happened to screen grab it. Is that right?
Yeah.
It just so happened because he deleted it soon after.
Right away.
This was when Twitter was not big.
Right.
This is when Twitter was probably 5% of its size, maybe, of what it is now.
What was it, literally 2009, 10?
I mean, no, it was like 11 or 12, 11 or 12. I think. But you
not 12. I had to be 11 then.
Yeah, but yeah, and so he was one of the top politicians on the Democrat side.
Yeah,
you guys might not remember this.
A rising star, big time.
He was a rising star. And,
come on,
and then,
come on,
and then he almost ran for mayor afterwards, which is amazing. What was so great about that story though was the press conference.
Yeah, the best.
And then Andrew did a press conference in response.
Yeah, Andrew hijacked Anthony Weiner's resignation press conference. And he took questions, and everyone, and he goes through. It's all on YouTube. It's my literal favorite video on all of YouTube.
It's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. And Andrew's just, he goes up there very politely and saying, you guys keep saying Breitbart lies. Where is the lie? Where's one lie? And this is the thing that you talked about. Journalism used to reward boldness. It used to be the people who were willing to put their neck out there to search for something that others were not looking for, and then ride it, even when people who are their friends are saying that maybe you shouldn't be doing this. Maybe this is not a good use of time. And to start peeling that onion back. Now what's rewarded in journalism, whoever is the wittiest dunk on Trump on Twitter, That's not real life. That's fake. That is a bubble. And that is something that is doing the service of the corporations who are not looking to preserve American values at this time.
So you just made me think of something I really want to explore. But first, I just want to add one more part on the Anthony Weiner thing. You've heard me say this multiple times before. But I had this whole thing on how Andrew Breitbart, may he rest in peace, April 2012, is that right? April 1st?
It was March 1st.
March 1st.
Yeah.
2012, he passed away. And his legacy still lives on, I think, stronger than ever. I wrote my first ever piece for Breitbart.com, by the way. And God bless Breitbart for giving me that platform. When I was in high school, exposing liberal textbooks, by the way. And now look what's happened, right? So Breitbart deserves a lot of thanks for that. And Joel Pollack was the one that I fed him the story because of all the nonsense that was being taught.
And Charlie, you never tell them my role in this. That I approached Charlie to try to come work for me.
I remember this.
This is the last free day Charlie had in his life.
That's right.
We were hanging out at a South Carolina Tea Party.
You know what? I remember this.
And
You're right.
It was bad weather. And so we were all kind of trapped in this dive bar that was there waiting for between speeches.
Terrible.
It was not fun. Myrtle Beach, it's a better idea. I like the idea of Myrtle Beach.
Yeah. You get there and you're like, oh, people are great.
I love South Carolina, but that was terrific people.
So anyway.
Terrific. But I tried to hire Charlie and Charlie had said, well, this Turning Point thing I think it's going to take off. Like it's a little bigger. I like the idea, but you know what? The Turning Point thing, I think it's got legs. I think this could work. And I'm like, are you sure? Like just youth group? Don't they already have those? All right, you let me know. You come back to me later. All right, I can wait a little bit.
And
I called that one wrong and a little late, but it worked out well for you, Charlie.
Well, and for all of our students and our amazing leaders. So Andrew passed away in 2012. And so, as you all know, right before the 2016 election, there was what was called the October surprise when James Comey came out and issued a letter, you guys might remember this, that changed the news cycle, saying that there was evidence to show that Hillary Clinton might have had something to do with the illegal deletion of emails. Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
That if she wasn't completely exonerated.
Right.
So this was a couple days before the 2016 election. James Comey still gets blamed for this and saying that it got Donald Trump elected. Well, the story behind the story actually involves Andrew Breitbart. So that only happened because of a raid that was executed on Anthony Weiner's home. Now, you might say, well, how does that have to do with Hillary Clinton? Well, Anthony Weiner was married to a woman by the name of Huma Abedin, Hillary Clinton's friend. And so, very good friend. And we don't know anything else besides that they're friends.
No. Bestie friends, as I think it says in Wikipedia.
Right. So that's there. So they grab this hard drive, Anthony Weiner's hard drive, and the Bureau doing their job, which was actually a nice thing to talk about, goes through and they realize that unrelated to the Anthony Weiner investigation, they have Hillary Clinton data in this hard drive and this database.
Amazing.
Because of Hillary Clinton and her friendship with Huma Abedin, right? And so then all of a sudden James Comey gets this presented to him and releases the letter that very well might have turned the 2016 election towards Donald Trump. And the only reason they were able to get the raid on Anthony Weiner and get a judge to sign off on it was because a man by the name of Andrew Breitbart broke the story against Anthony Weiner. And that's how Andrew Breitbart changed the course of history.
It's so cool.
By one act of journalism.
It's so cool. And I have a theme throughout the book. Those of you who've read it will know that all roads lead back to Breitbart. And it's just amazing that I've got to witness so much of this stuff. We really were at the tip of the spear of so many elements of the culture war. And it's just great to see a lot of people take the lessons of Andrew, but more have to, which is what another great service I can do. Now that I've got more, I've been platformed more since the book came out. People platform me. It is a great thing to evangelize on Andrew's lessons. He understood so much about how the fight needs to take place. He had two modes, jocularity and righteous indignation. Those are the two. The jocularity, meaning having a great time, make it fun, enjoy yourself while you're making life difficult for the left. And when the time is right, you got to fight hard and don't give an inch. And I'm pretty mild-mannered personally, and I still never give an inch. And you can do that. You can live that way. You don't have to always be pugilistic and, you know, going up to Antifa and putting your your face into their face and them hitting you with a, you know, a frozen bottle of urine or whatever they do. Even though, by the way, those people who do it are heroes, and we should be a grateful for those journalists who are doing that on the right. But that said, you don't have to be that person. You can be a mild-mannered person and still be a principled conservative who sticks to your guns and does not give in to the left, which was one of his biggest mottos, which I think he got from Rush, I think. But that the left will never compromise with you. And this cannot be said enough. They are not looking to compromise. They are on a search and destroy mission. And the book, I think, provides at least 1,000 examples of that being true.
And he gives Rush credit for that.
Yeah.
Because Andrew was a liberal until he started listening to the Clarence Thomas hearings and Rush.
Right.
He was listening to Rush in Los Angeles. May Rush rest in peace. Big shoes to fill, my goodness. And we're going to talk about that, Alex, of all the, you know, the work that needs to be done. Because Rush in the early 90s, you guys want to talk about cancel culture. They tried to cancel Rush early. You might, some of you might remember that. They went hard after Rush in 93, 94, 95. And there was this famous 60 Minutes interview where they did with Rush. And they said, are you going to apologize for calling women feminazis? And he said, apologize? He said, it's true. And it was, you know, and it went all over the place. And of course, I'm paraphrasing, but it was all of a sudden it sent a signal to the rest of the conservative movement of the Neville Chamberlain Republicans to not sue for peace.
Right.
To actually say, you know what? No, we can stand behind that. And Andrew learned from that. So Alex, what I want to ask you, which is a direction I think Andrew would appreciate, is the type of liberals I grew up with and the type of liberals you grew up with.
Yeah.
And a lot of you will, I think this will resonate with a lot of you. For some of the younger people out there, you might not be able to see this the same way.
Yeah.
But I grew up with Sierra Club liberals, you know, that actually they hated corporate power.
Right.
They were the ones that used to scream in the streets about not having their children being vaccinated. They were the ones that used to say they hate, you know, the mega corporations. They were the ones that said, let us go live in the hills and let us go live our own life. And that was kind of the liberal left that I grew up with. I don't agree with them, obviously, but there was kind of this kind of part that we were always kind of, we had some sort of admiration to the Dennis Kucinich liberals or to the people that were willing to chain themselves to the Sequoia tree when they're, you know, when they're just trying to put in a shopping mall. You know what I'm talking about? Where they're like, you know what? I want to go live a normal way of life and screw you big corporations. And I don't care what it's going to cost me. But now it seems that, and this is why I think what's happening in American politics is so unsustainable and why conservatives are about to see a massive positive movement in our direction if we do a couple things, is because liberals have now become the protectors of corporate power, which at their very definition is at odds of everything they're supposed to believe.
I hope this book resets. If it accomplishes one thing, I hope it is that this book sells 1 billion copies. If it accomplishes two things, I hope that it resets people's take on the fact that corporations are not just on the left, but they're working openly against America's best interests, and they have been totally co-opted by not just the left, the globalist left, the left that is left, unless of course their business interests in China, and then all of a sudden they're corporatists for a while. And this is a very dangerous ideology. And it is one that does not have an ample opposition to it at this point, at this time. And you're identifying something that is so profound to me, having been a UC Berkeley graduate. And I went there during the Bush years. And I was told constantly that the real problems in America were the corporations. Only it was Exxon and it was Halliburton. These were the corporations that were ruining the world. And why would we all want to be corporate sellouts? Well, all of a sudden, as the millennials who grew up on a steady diet of leftism and secularism, let's not forget the secularism, and that America is not a uniquely great place and that America is not particularly exceptional. Now, they're working their ways up through the corporations now, and they're in there, and they've been told their whole life that the ideal is to essentially become a part of a great corporation. That's the whole point of your 20s. It's not to start a family and have kids and commune with nature and commune with our founding documents and to worship God. It's the whole point of the world, not to be a pillar of your community. It's to be a part of a great corporation. And how much time you can spend Starting your own Facebook or joining your own Facebook if you can't start it, or being a part of Apple or Google. Look at how cool Google's campus is. They work 4 days a week. They have luxury shuttle buses and a cool cafeteria. They got real chefs in the cafeteria. That is the point of life? You'd be kidding me. You'd absolutely be kidding me. And unfortunately, people my age and younger, and I'm a little older than you, Charlie, probably older than I like to admit, I got a good 20, 25 years of this. And that's what's happening, is now people my age moving into senior management or middle management. And this is the message being pushed down, especially for you ladies out there that say, by all means, I'm all for freedom. Do whatever you want to do with your life. If your goal is to be a super high powered lawyer, to work at a Merrill Lynch or a Goldman Sachs, or that's what you want to do, do it. By all means, do it. It's free country. It's a great country that way. But don't be convinced just because the culture is telling you your life is supposed to be about being a subservient to a corporation. It's absurd when I put it that way, but who puts it that way? A few people. Luckily, Tucker's putting it that way. There's a few others who are out there, but very few people are doing it.
Well, not only that, the corporations are telling young women to go freeze their eggs. Like, oh, you could put that on hold and you can now go work for, be some cog in a machine and go be totally miserable for 10 years of your life and complain about everything. But here's how they've convinced them to do it, is that the same people that used to go join the Peace Corps are now going to go work for Google because they're convinced that Google is a vehicle for massive social change. How many of you remember people that used to go work in the Peace Corps, right? Exactly. Idealistic. Sure. We're going to change the world. Those people now go work for Google. So the Peace Corps Kennedy people now took over Google, and they say, oh, you can code? Well, now we can code racism away. That's actually what they say. Like, if you have talent, you can go and earn $200,000 a year and go kick Charlie Kirk and Alex Marlowe off YouTube, and we're going to save the world together. And I actually think there's a fault line in this, though.
Yeah.
I think that this is about to crack and break for a lot of different reasons. And look, we hate corporations for completely different reasons than why they hate them. They hate corporations. They're supposed to, because of private property. They don't like private property. They don't like entrepreneurship. They tend to not like the profit motive. We obviously are critics of the excesses of individualism, but we hate corporations largely because they hate our country and hate our values. And we also hate them because they have amassed such economic power and they don't pay their workers well, and they are willing to act more like a government, and they don't actually have a duty or responsibility to their fellow countrymen. But I think that this kind of rebellion against the top 100 companies in our country, I think it's already coming. And I think I think it's bipartisan. I think that it is something that is going to manifest itself in a way that is truly profound.
Do you think that what Lorraine Powell Jobs is doing is the spirit of our founding fathers and democracy and one person, one vote?
Well, what I think, I just have to say,
do you think that with her behind the scenes on her yacht somewhere? It's a gorgeous yacht, by the way. The Daily Mail got photos of it.
Is it three stories?
At least, it feels like it. It's like a wedding cake, but a boat. And do you think what she's doing with her secretly using her inherited wealth, which you talked about brilliantly on your radio show about how that's probably a big factor, that, you know, she inherits all this wealth. Do you think what she's doing is the spirit of this country? Of course not. But it's legal. It is legal.
But it's not ethical. It's a big difference. And that's where we have to motivate our Republicans to do
something. Well, and we used to trust the journalists to suss this stuff out, but now they're all on the payroll. And if they're not in the payroll now, maybe they will be next time when they get a new gig.
Well, and so Lorraine Powell Jobs, first of all, I just find it hilarious that she likes Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson would hate her.
And she loves Malcolm X. She's got a big Malcolm X mural.
Well, he would really hate her because he hated white liberals. And he actually did. There's a whole Malcolm X Black Panther movement against white liberals. So that's really interesting. But if I could just say one thing about the Lorraine Powell Jobs, what I mentioned on the podcast, which is, I think that the greatest driver in American politics, I just talked to Tucker about this, and it's going to air sometime soon, I think it's Americans' inability to deal with guilt. And, you know, we as Christians have a way to deal with guilt. When you do something wrong, we actually have the mechanics to be able to deal with that, whether it be taking the Eucharist or talking to that person, you know, asking for forgiveness from your Creator. When you secularize a society, how do you deal with guilt? Well, you go give a bunch of money away to activist causes, because maybe that will make you feel a little less terrible for your white skin color. And then you feel guilty for things you shouldn't even feel guilty about. And so the entire pressure on our American political system right now and in our country is a bunch of people that have a lot of stuff and they can't quite explain why they have that stuff. And so they try to reconcile that with this feeling of guilt that is pressed upon them by the rest of society by funding incredibly destructive activist causes, purchasing the Atlantic. And I think that's exactly Laureen Powell Jobs. So she's the ultimate example of unearned wealth. Now, a lot of people have unearned wealth. A lot of you in this room, myself included, had some unearned advantage. If you grew up in a home by parents, you didn't earn that. You were born into that. But at some point, you kind of turn the corner, if you will, from unearned to earned, right? Where you take out debt in your own name. You're like, okay, 18 years you paid for me. Now I'm on my own. She never turned that corner. You see, she never had to do the thing where she had to sign on a dotted line, and it was her. She married well. Congratulations. And she got a disproportionate outcome for marrying well. So she doesn't know how to deal with this money. So she sits in a room with her accountants and they say, well, you're worth $20 billion. And she thinks to herself, well, that was just basically given to me. She never had to reflect back on the firing she had to make. She never had to reflect back on Steve Jobs feeling sick to his stomach, being kicked out of his own company. She never had to reflect back on changing a product before a product launch. What I'm saying is she had no skin in the game in that money. So therefore and I'm not saying it should be illegal. I'm just making a simple ethical argument of why she acts this way, where all of a sudden she has a $20 billion parachute and there's no memory of why she has it. Where if you talk to any other entrepreneur, it's like you talk to her husband, he'd say, oh, no. That $20 billion, I'm going to try to preserve some form of that because I know why and how I got it.
Yeah. And this is a phenomenon that you've identified that will continue to play out in this country the way it is now. And I'm not saying that we don't want people to have the ability to earn. And we love the rugged individualist spirit. We love it that a individual of exceptional aptitude and drive can achieve in this country. That's amazing. But your identity shouldn't be a cog in a corporate machine. And if you do happen to amass all this wealth, and for it to be used, these people that have so much money, it's unfathomable, for them to continue to put that money into their causes that are political is incredibly dangerous. And I'm not saying it should be banned, but it does need to be identified. Take what Mark Zuckerberg did during the election. And I'll tell you, the supervillains of the book is big tech. They're the overlords over it all. They're called the masters of the universe in the book because that's what they are. And never have a group of unelected people, not saying we want to elect people to businesses, but they're unelected, they're anonymous, we don't know who they are, and they're unbelievably powerful. It's never happened in the history of the world that these people can make your business sink or swim. It's if they turn off Breitbart right now, they could just say, we're done with these guys. They're complaining about me too much on all the tech platforms. That would make my life very difficult. Wouldn't put us out of business because we're big enough. But now picture the next Breitbart. Knowing that they're going to go into those headwinds. I don't do much on YouTube. You want to know why? And I'm embarrassed to say this. It's because I know YouTube is going to get, if I have a level of success, YouTube is going to take a dial and they're going to turn it down because YouTube's Google. And I see what Google does to Breitbart. Breitbart's traffic from Google to Joe Biden's stories got erased literally to zero. May of last year, they literally flipped the switch and said no more Joe Biden content to Breitbart. Period, from Google, unless you add the word Breitbart in it. And this is something that the tech giants are doing. We don't know who's doing it, but we do know that they're all worth incalculable amounts of money, and that money is getting spread around Democrat candidates, left-wing causes. Mark Zuckerberg is the poster boy of this with his election integrity effort, which was a big head fake. This was like MTV's Get Out the Vote. MTV's Rock the Vote. That's incredible. That was quick.
What?
You were on it with the correction.
Oh no, I just we talked about it.
Yeah, but it was good. He's my ombudsman.
No, yeah, I'll tell you why we were quick on it in a second.
Yeah, but this was MTV did Rock the Vote in the 90s and the 2000s, where they would say we love getting out the vote. Voting is great, which we all agree on. But who were they really empowering to vote? A bunch of uninformed Democrats were sitting around watching MTV. So it was all a trick, and it was done. Done in a way where you couldn't question it because I love voting. You love voting. Voting's great. But they're only targeting a bunch of Democrats who wouldn't otherwise vote. That's what Mark Zuckerberg did. Is that he says, I love election integrity. This is great. Let's put these drop boxes in these Democrat areas. Do you think that's a coincidence that they showed up in those Democrat areas? Of course not. And say, do you think he spent hundreds of millions of dollars on it because he just woke up one day and decide, you know what? My cause is election integrity. No, it's that Donald Trump was a threat to big tech and Joe Biden is not. That is why Mark Zuckerberg did that. And anyone who is telling you otherwise is lying to your face.
That's right. And so the issue with tech is that we used to have really rich people in our country that actually loved their country. I mean, Andrew Carnegie and Mellon and Rockefeller and Chase, they loved America and they invested heavily in America. And so they invested in hospitals or veterans, rehabilitation, centers or libraries. And they were obviously challenged by Teddy Roosevelt, which I actually think was a very good thing. Some people disagree with me, but I'll make an argument that it actually prevented a Leninist style revolution from taking hold because we were close to having one that kind of had a little mini progressive movement that still had a lot of damage through Woodrow Wilson. But there was a legitimate Marxist movement brewing in America in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And Teddy Roosevelt kind of moderated that. And that's a contrarian view as some people in conservative circles. What makes it different, though, is you know how you now have the richest people in our country that really have no such loyalty to the country. Bezos is like $165 billion. He's like, yeah, America. He's like, I'll just go to Singapore. It's like, so what if this place falls? If Andrew Carnegie even thought for a second something would be bad for America, he wouldn't do that. Leland Stanford built the railroad because he thought it would help strengthen America. You could read it in his journals. He wanted to make money, obviously, and he took a daring risk and made a lot of money. And there were some things done, obviously, in the construction of the railroad that were probably less than ethical by today's labor standards. But his drive in his own private journals, and that's him talking to himself, is that this will make America an industrial superpower.
So, Charlie, I'm going to do something that I often do when I'm getting interviewed, because I host a radio show, by the way, on Breitbart News Daily and Sirius XM Patriot 125. It's a little early for you guys, 3 a.m., So, but it's on podcast if you get the Sirius XM app. But I'm normally in the interviewer chair. So I'm going to switch it around to you. What do you think the change is? When did we go from the people who maybe they didn't vote the same all the time, but they at least got that America was this incredible experiment that needs to be preserved? And now we get that America is, what's Hillary Clinton's ultimate goal? Hemispheric open borders. Exactly right. We're just a blob of mass between Mexico and Canada. We're not particularly special. In fact, our founding documents, if you want to believe critical race theory, they're horrible because a bunch of whites came up with them. It's the,
yeah,
what
so
changed?
My answer will be maybe not expected by some people, but I think this all changed right when the Soviet Union fell. And Russell Kirk predicted this, of which I have no relation. He said, America's not going to know how to deal with themselves once the Soviet Union falls. And his prediction was basically down to the day correct. You guys remember in the 80s, it's the only thing that kept the conservative movement together. Libertarians played nicely with conservatives and neocons. Everyone agreed Soviet Union's got to go. And Ronald Reagan made it a theological debate. He said that we get our rights from God. They don't believe in God. We are going to win without firing a shot or a missile. And we did. And so then the Soviet Union falls and H.W. Bush was president. And so then what kind of came was this moment of, and it really was never described like this by historians, but it was almost like, well, now we can kind of indulge in the pleasure of being the world superpower. So we then started to look at America and the corporate class, which then, of course, Bezos and Gates were a disciple of, as a colony, not as a country. So what did we do in 1991? We passed Mass Immigration Act with Ted Kennedy to bring 1.3 million legally into our country every single year. 1.3 million people legally into our country, which, of course, was a handout to the Chamber of Commerce and to left-wingers that wanted to see cheaper votes. Well, then what did we happen a couple years after that? Well, we ratified NAFTA, a massive free trade agreement that deindustrialized our country and had a sort of hemispheric sort of equilibrium. And then, of course, in 1999, I call this, by the way, the four horsemen of the 1990s when baby boomers betrayed America, just so we're clear, right? Where baby boomers in the corporate class decided to put their own corporate profits first and not their country first and did the opposite of what Dwight D. Eisenhower would have done. No offense to baby boomers out there. It's just true that the people in charge that were making decisions, they made four awful decisions. In 99, it was Glass-Steagall. Like, let's all of a sudden merge commercial banking and investment banking, which was a disaster. There is no argument for it unless you're an ideologue. There's no argument unless you believe in slogans more than what's good for the country. Then finally, China is an acceptance in 2001 to the World Trade Organization. So from 1991 to 2001, we brought China into the World Trade Organization. We ratified NAFTA. We tripled the amount of legal immigrants we brought into America that had no sort of language assimilation, cultural assimilation. And then we also repealed all of our banking laws to have cheap money flow through our country. So what happened, Alex, was that Bezos and Gates and Sergey Brin, they're all students. They grew up looking at that as the way you run a company. And that was a lot because we didn't have the Soviet Union as a hedge. You see, during the 70s and 80s, there was an anchor being like, well, maybe we shouldn't bring in 1.3 million people into our country, because then what if all of a sudden we lose our advantage and that national assimilation because Soviet Union is going to take us over? The Soviet Union kept us in check. And I know this is a weird argument for some people to hear, but the Soviet Union was actually the sword of Damocles over America that was like, no, we can't do these awful things or else we won't be able to compete against the Soviets. As soon as they got taken off the chessboard, it was like, hey, party time, bring in the immigrants, cheap labor, tons of plastic, cheap money, China, the World Trade Organization. Who cares? We're a colony, not a country. And now we are living under the consequences of that.
So we have that now, and it's China. And we've got this connection with the book because the media does not take this seriously at all. In fact, they love being cooperative with China on all manner of things. They don't care that China is the least free place in the world for journalists. You virtually don't get any news out of China that isn't filtered through their propaganda administration, which I investigate thoroughly in the book. And then you've got their in the pandemic, the only major nation that had their GDP go up, they grew. The GDP grew. We all bought their stupid masks that we now learn from Fauci this week didn't work. But he admitted it. Of course, we all knew it. We all knew the masks were the made in China paper masks were going to stop a global pandemic. But we all wore it for a year. By the way, where I was at earlier today in Los Angeles, I mean, it's over 100% masking. There's still, because you still get the double masking going on. So it's an average over one made in China mask per person. And so what do we do? Because the sword of Damocles, we should be acknowledging it, Charlie, but why don't we see it? Is it just as simple as the almighty dollar?
Well, yes. And then I want to get to some questions, which is, I've done a lot of thinking about this. I don't know the complete answer. I think the secularization of America played a lot into this. I also think that there is this very slow moving of the framework of what it means to be a model citizen, where the ultimate value of being an American was not acting ethically and having a lot of children and being faithful to your church. But slowly, it was almost like a slow motion move where all of a sudden it was like, who has the amount of plastic? And that's never been what made our country exceptional. And that's kind of what was sold to us. It's like, no, I got more plastic than you do. I'm a great American. It's like, no, actually, our country was the most prosperous country ever because we had some non-negotiables, which was like, hey, we actually care more about whether or not we're having children in our country, then we have self-storage units full of stuff we never wear and we have no attachment to. So I want to get to some questions because they're eager.
Can I say something? Because I know the motto here, Turning Point, is big gov sucks.
And big tech sucks.
Yeah. And now we should add big corp sucks.
Yeah. So we're going to keep adding to that little sign.
Big corp sucks.
Well, and
this is where I think you and I together can make a point here, particularly for young people, is you can love capitalism without loving corporatism. You can love capitalism and not believe your identity should be some part of one of these major conglomerates. And you can love capitalism without loving materialism.
That's exactly right.
And I love nice stuff and I want to have nice stuff, but it should be, you get it methodically. You don't just get nice stuff for the sake of nice stuff. It should have a purpose. It could be a treat to you, and try to support the businesses that are, you know, not a bunch of plastic crap from China. But it's not just going to be plastic crap from China. It's going to be cheap infrastructure from China. It already is cheap generic drugs from China. We need to be talking about this stuff on a constant basis and pushing back, because we're already in the hole. It's going to take decades to uncouple ourselves from China. But we have to start now. And let me give a good place to start. Got to boycott the Olympics. No Olympics in China. Absolutely no Olympics in China. No way we legitimize them on that level.
So you mentioned earlier Lorraine Powell Jobs and how nobody had heard of her. And so we had a show of hands. And so I have another question. It's a Supreme Court decision called Packingham versus North Carolina. Is there a show of hands of anybody that's ever heard of that? Okay.
You got me.
That is a 2017 opinion. a unanimous opinion by the U.S. Supreme Court. And in it, it mentions specifically Facebook and Twitter, and it defines how freedom of speech is going to be protected moving forward. And so you aptly mentioned the word deplatformed and the YouTube algorithm. Packingham says that their platforms are the public square, and speech is protected in the public square, not only your right to speak it, but my right to listen to you say it. And so this, if I read it correctly, this is the end of Section 230.
Well, so then my question is, being unfamiliar with the case, though, I would not be shocked to be covered in a Breitbart. My question is then, how do we bridge the gap? Because clearly, culturally, these platforms are doing whatever they want, and no one is holding them accountable, left, right, or center in Washington, regardless of what the letter of the law says, which is my whole beef with big tech in general, which is the letter of the law is that, sure, they can, so long as the laws are where they are right now, they can censor whoever they want until the laws are reformed. But is that the spirit of the First Amendment? Is that the spirit of free speech, that you, all these guys, Mark Zuckerberg with his weird haircut, gets to just choose?
Well,
which
the answer to your question is in the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process section of the Constitution. It says nobody can take away your fundamental liberties without due process of law and equal protection. So if they're deplatforming or shadow banning you, they got to be doing the same thing to everybody else. And due process means you get to your day in court. And so you get to make your case before something that resembles a fair tribunal, and then get justice on a case by case basis. So you, the enforcement mechanism is in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. And that's what was passed, by the way.
Here's the thing, though, is that I'm a journalist and a talk show host. And what power do I have personally? Because it seems like something that would be, have to go through the courts, or at least go through our lawmakers. And how come none of them get it if what you're saying is true? And it sounds very reasonable to me. But why don't the Marsha Blackburns and the Haggertys and the Tom Cottons and the people who get this stuff, why haven't they done anything yet?
Because the legal profession, there's people within the legal profession that know what I'm talking about, but they can't say anything because of the coercive control of how they're regulated by the state bar.
Interesting.
They'll lose their license to practice law.
Did you say this is a U.S. Supreme Court decision?
Yeah. Everybody from Ruth Bader Ginsburg to Clarence Thomas unanimously said, and named specifically, Facebook and Twitter are their platforms are the public square where speech is protected.
Okay, well, if you send me an email at alex@breitbart.com, I will look into it.
Yeah, I'd like to look at your document too.
Yeah, I would love to look into it more.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm guessing, though, unfortunately, that there's something that is preventing that to become the law of the land. It sounds great, but I don't have the benefit of having the details in front of me.
Mises University, that's a fun place. Welcome.
It's good to be here. Okay, I don't think there's any question about how important it would be for conservatives to have our own social media platforms. And there's been some talk that Trump was going to start one. There's some other people. Even if we don't have a prominent politician to actually fund it and start it, there are enough of them out there. I think that it might be incumbent on us if we could just get a group of leaders, pundits, maybe a few politicians, some journalists, to all get together and say, this is the social media platforms that we're going to migrate to, and we're all going to do it on one day.
So Breitbart's very powerful on social media, but Charlie's arguably the biggest guy on social media on the right. So, Charlie, what do you think?
I used to be on Twitter, and then we had a little bit of a fight. I'm still on Twitter, but I kind of passively protest them after they banned Trump. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go direct my attentions and my, you know.
Exactly.
I remember, this is such a ridiculous sidebar. Do you guys remember when LeBron James did that ridiculous announcement when he said, it's like, I'm going to take my talents to Miami? That's what I did with Twitter. It's like, I'm going to take, you remember that? Yeah. That ridiculous thing with all the children in the background.
It was called The Decision.
No, that's right. It was a whole show. It was, anyway, I'm going to take my Twitter, my talents outside of Twitter. Rumble's trying.
Who would have thought LeBron James turned out to be an egomaniac? Amazing, right?
But, and by the way, the shock what the a year. Difference between Michael Jordan and him. Let me just say, he will never be Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan was such a class act, and he was just terrific. I did not expect to talk about that tonight, but Rumble is great. RUMBLE.com. The next time you guys want to look at a video, go to rumble.com, download the app. Everyone should download the Rumble app. We're going to be posting there a lot more. I'm personally working with them. I actually have more subscribers on Rumble than I do on YouTube.
Wow. And, that's amazing.
And so,
my thoughts are, I'm an all the above guy. I am a break up big tech, reform antitrust laws to put pressure on big tech, amend Section 230 so that, you know, places that have 100 million users or whatever aren't allowed to just censor willy nilly based on politics. All that stuff should be done. And then we should build our own stuff. And it's not going to work all the time. Parler got kicked off by Amazon. We were always told just build your own Twitter. So Parler did, and they got kicked off and they got their business destroyed by Amazon. So, but they're playing catch up and it looks like they're on the right track, and I'm rooting for them and I'm rooting for Rumble. So it's got to be both. It's got to be all the above, and it's got to be a robust effort. And I really do think that the conservative donor class has to get involved on this too, that they have to understand that the culture wars now are being fought in these social media platforms, like it or not. And for me, it's usually not. I don't like these things. I'm not nearly as good at it as Charlie is. I have no interest in being as good at it as Charlie is. No offense, Charlie. We have to do all the above approach. And this includes creating an environment where people can try and fail and they can launch their startup and it might not work out, but maybe the next one does. Maybe the next one does go big.
Well, and I'll just add to that as well. There is a, and we're pretty good at kind of seeing the next move. There is, it's 5 years from now, if we keep this pressure on, considering the first two questions in line were about big tech here tonight, I'm confident there's going to be a change. There are 75 million or more of us that are displeased with this current corporate oligarchy. And you just saw Peter Thiel put some money into Rumble, which is a great sign because that's an institutional investor that is that picked Facebook early. And so, but I think the real fight, and this is what I would have loved to see the state of Arizona do, but whatever Arizona is doing right now, I don't know. That's a different form for a different time. Come to Freedom Square at Dream City Church this coming Tuesday, because we're gonna talk about that, because it's all Arizona. That's kind of our Arizona night, right? Because we're gonna have a lot to say, everybody, about Arizona. Because I'm not happy about that. Is the states need to be going after these tech companies big time? Ron DeSantis is showing the playbook. The states have a ton of power to say, no, you can't mine the data of our citizens. You've got to put pressure on these companies. These are trillion-dollar companies that are making money off of you. Only addictive drugs and social media companies call the people that use their products users. Think about that.
That's pretty good. Well, by the way, what's a football Saturday like at Mises University?
No, so that's an institute at Auburn University that's named after Ludwig von Mises.
Right.
Wow.
Well, Auburn, then it's probably fun.
Yeah, Tom Woods talks there and everything. They're super libertarian, which obviously all of you guys know.
I've read some Mises. I probably don't have it memorized, committed to memory.
Well, Money, Something, and Credit is his most famous book. And I love the monetary theory stuff, though. The one thing that he got the best was how our money supply is used and abused by corrupt people to try to declare wars and deteriorate purchasing power. You'll lose me on immigration, on libertarianism, but I appreciate the enthusiasm for wanting to crush the Federal Reserve.
Cool.
Thank you.
Cool.
All right. Question.
My question is boring, I guess, but do journalists require a state or federal license in order to do what they do? And I require a license to do what I do. And in my license, they say if you commit fraud or you lie, you will lose your license and you can't practice that anymore. And I figure that holds me accountable for what I say. And you would think that journalists would have some sort of accountability. I don't understand why they don't have to be licensed. Can you explain that to me?
I can't explain it. The only problem I have with that is that who's going to be in charge of giving out the new licenses? It's the who's going to be the licensees. It's going to be the same establishment that we're complaining about, unfortunately. I do wish that there was a clearer delineation between rights that should be states' rights and rights that are federal rights. I think we all embrace that. It's a not just because in our Constitution, but also because it makes red states look a lot better when that happens. If you guys hadn't watched the last few months of what's happening in America. Unfortunately, I don't know. This is another one of those questions where it's a fundamental, and I feel like the waters are so muddied right now that it's very hard to rein this stuff in. I've been spending out a lot of time in California, which actually had a budget surplus last year because while many Americans were told to stay home, big tech was just working from home, making more money than they've ever made. And so the tax revenue was huge in California. And so what's Newsom doing? He's doing a vaccine lottery where he's paying the citizens with their own money to get the experimental vaccine, which is like he's like paying them with their money. Like, look, they will give you some of your money back if you just get this vaccine. Are people really lacking information on the vaccine at this point? I think people have made up their mind. I think people have made intelligent decisions on the vaccine. And what else is he doing now? He's doing a reparations commission. Charlie, was California a slave state?
No. In fact, if anyone should pay reparations, it should be Mexico, because a lot of Mexican military was actually occupying most of California.
You should apologize to Mexico.
Before the Catholic missions, basically, used to be California.
So this is the thing, is that we're so insane now where I wish we get those fundamentals. But Charlie, you probably given this, you're good on these fundamental issues. What do you think?
So on the journalist kind of accreditation, or more broadly,
just in general, his point about the licenses.
Well, I think the point is actually a really good one, because you feel as if these people have so much power, and why is it you need a license to cut hair but not to destroy someone's life through writing a story? And I think that's actually the good intention. I agree with Alex wholeheartedly, which is there is something exciting and I think moral and good about anyone being able to be a journalist, right? That you could just pull up your smartphone and be able to ask questions of Lorene Powell Jobs next time any of you see her at the local yacht club. There's something that's actually really exciting about that. With that being said, I don't think it would be a good idea. I do think, though, that there should be. And this is the way that you can kind of circumvent it, which is what's happened in the right to work states, which is you have a private licensing organization of a quality of a carpenter or a plumber. So it doesn't need to be government mandated, but it's like, no, this person is a blue chip reporter because people will know what that means and you'll only talk to them. This is already happening naturally, where Alex and I, there are certain reporters we will not talk to and we've already de-licensed them. There's no need for that to be done through some government agency. Does that make sense? Like, you're a total scumbag. Yeah. I'm not talking to you. And like, you might as, it doesn't matter if you have a license or not. And I think that's actually part of what Alex does in this book, is kind of exposing people of who to look at, who to trust, and who not to trust.
Yeah, unfortunately, this is definitely a lesser of evils decision. It's the put the licenses in place, and we all rejoice until the licensees, or the people in charge of giving the licenses, are compromised, which will happen. Or we just do it now, which is kind of not great, but is potentially better so long as we keep empowering those independent, conservative and not even conservative, by the way. And there's a lot of great reporting coming out of independent people on the left who are willing to stand up.
The anti-war people.
Totally. Especially. It's the person who is probably quoted most frequently in the book. I don't know if he is in the final draft. In the first draft was Glenn Greenwald, a guy who I disagree with on probably more than half the stuff, but the guy has integrity and he is very open about what he believes, where he's coming from, and he brings the heat. He brings the facts and the data, and he's not, and again, also mild-mannered. Like, I love that personality in people who are mild-mannered but do not back down, and you got to bring it if you're going to debate them on stuff. I love that, and we got to get back to that. We need more people like that.
And I want to just say one other thing. You mentioned the vaccine. I did a whole podcast on this. And if you got the vaccine, that's fine. That's obviously your decision. I decided not to get it. And I'm not going to impose my opinion because it's a very intimate and personal medical decision. What I think we can all agree on, though, is that our children and our college students should not be forced to get vaccinated. Mandatory vaccinations are a bridge too far. And what we have to do, so there are three fights that are brewing this summer: mandatory vaccinations, school boards, and the audits. Just those, this summer, we can't just take it easy. It's not a summer where we're just like, I hope things are going to get better. We have to put points on the board on those three things, everybody.
So, okay. So let me respond to a couple of these. First of all, vaccines. I come from a family of science. It's actually not a joke. My wife's family are all scientists, and most of the doctors in the family are getting the vaccine. And I'll tell you that not everyone, most of them, and I'll tell you to a number, they will tell you they should not be mandated. I'll tell you that's for sure. Should not be mandated. They're available. We got the information. They're working miraculously well, it appears, but it is not on the government to mandate it for something where young, healthy people are surviving. And the pandemic is already winding down. We know enough of the patterns, and we don't know that much about the vaccine that you have to force people to do it. People can make up their own minds. But I want to talk to you about the audits, because I get a lot of my audit information from you guys and your guy Tyler, who checks in. Tell me where we're at on that stuff.
Yeah, it's still going on. So the audit here is really tricky. It's because we're constantly battling kind of other forces that want to shut it down. So I'm going to tell you what we do on our podcast, and I encourage you guys to check in on it, because we're super careful and disciplined. And the reason we don't do daily is because I never want to do hopium. I can't stand hopium, which is hope and opium mixed together, things that sound good, that make you feel good, but they're not true.
We should apologize to the Hopis.
No, but yeah. But and you guys know there's some, I'm not going to say, there's just people out there that publish stuff that might not yet be. We try to never say anything on our podcast or at Turning Point USA that we would not say under oath, right? And so that's a high standard, right? We could speculate, we can ask questions, but I could tell you this, that how much they're trying to shut down this audit, there is going to be something that's discovered here. Now, what that means and what that gets unfolded, we don't know. But I think that this is going to continue to progress, and I think other states need to continue with the audit. But here's the problem, is that I don't want to get people's hopes up that there's going to be some reversal or someone get put into office. I'm not that person. I'm not going to mislead you. I think that's actually very, very unhealthy. Do I think there might be discoveries that can lead to hopefully some very serious structural changes? Yes. Why the governor of this state vetoed 22 voter integrity bills yesterday is beyond unacceptable to me.
And I have a whole chapter on this in the book, and it's pretty complicated, and I'm kind of relieved we didn't get into it, because it's really hard to talk about
in
an off-the-cuff forum. But I meticulously went state by state in many of the key swing states, and I went through exactly where things went wrong in terms of voter integrity. And if you're looking for the spy thriller, Dominion was created by Hugo Chavez and bought by the Chinese and put in Frankfurt, and they were flipping votes, you're going to be very disappointed. I found none of that. But I did find infinite amounts of impropriety that needs to be examined by any responsible American, not just Republicans. Any responsible American should be very curious about this stuff, because it is a very dangerous game we're playing if our people lose faith in our elections. And we've had a couple in a row now where each side thinks that this was not legit, and that's not good.
It's really bad. It's very unhealthy for the Republic. So let me tell you where I think we need to focus our energy, and where I think the audit is going to lead to more questions. So here's my opinion. I don't think the audit's going to give us answers. I think it's going to give us a list of more questions. And that's a good thing, by the way. More questions and knowing where to go is a very healthy thing. So what questions are there? I think it's going to be around voter rolls, ballot practices, mass mail-in balloting, signature requirements, ballot custody, how votes are counted, who counts them. Those seven things I just said, I think we need to zero in on. It's a little bit more uncertain. There could be some truth there. I'm open-minded. We have segments on UFOs. Okay. So we're a very open-minded show. All right. Let me just be very clear. We're not like gatekeeping our way to trying to restrict opinions. With that being said, I don't think the machines are the hill to die on. Let me say it again. The machines, I don't think, are the hill to die on. The voting rolls are the easiest one to fix. There's court precedent to clean up voter rolls. There's precedent to get into it. So it's a super complicated topic, right, Alex? And we have to.
Totally.
And outside money, $400 million coming from Zuckerberg. It's a very difficult thing to talk about. And I'll just say one other thing. It's a failure of the people you put in charge, the fact they did not fix this when we saw this coming. And I'll just talk about this state, because I'm a little bit upset right now about Arizona.
Yeah, by all means.
And I sat in a meeting with President Trump in July of last year where Tyler told me, he's like, we're going to have problems with mail-in voting. And Tyler's the national committeeman here at in Arizona. Tyler knows his stuff. You listen to him on the Arizona audit stuff, and he's super precise in how he talks about this. And I told the president, and he totally agreed, by the way. But he was given assurances that everything was fine here in Arizona and everything was fine here in Georgia. He was lied to. There were so many problems with how the ballots got sent. Did anyone get here a ballot you didn't request here in Arizona? Did anyone get a ballot here? The fact that five hands went up shows that you extrapolate that with an electorate, and this was decided by 10,000 votes, and we know they never cheat, right? We know they act perfectly, ethically, honestly. They have never done anything illegal. They've never entrapped. They've never lied under oath. They've never went into the White House trying to put Michael Flynn to prison. In fact, I would let them run the country.
You make a compelling point.
Yeah. You guys know what I'm saying. And then Georgia's the other one. I don't mean to filibuster the time here. The point is that what just happened here, the 22
vetoes. Georgia's unbelievable. Can I throw out one? Just one thing. And I got
so
a whole section on this.
So preventable, which just frustrates me.
I got a whole section on this in the book. But the amount of Tucker got made fun of because he said the dead voted. Well, the dead did vote in Georgia. You know why? Because in Georgia, you could vote like 90 days before the election, something like that. And so there were a bunch of people who actually voted on the early end of that and were dead by the time election day came. It's because election day is now election quarter.
That's exactly
in the state of Georgia, which is, that's a high integrity system. Let's just vote for 3 months. Why not 6 months? Why can't I vote already for 2024 right now? Like, why cap it at 3 months? It's such an arbitrary number, and it's a number set by people who want to have the maximum amount of time to community organize the vote and to get all these people who alive or dead to vote early and vote often.
Well, and let me tell you where this is going.
Get that vote often. Not supposed to vote often.
And then
just once.
I want to get to this question. Let me tell you where this is going, which is why this democracy versus republic fight is so important. We're a republic, not a democracy. Because of technology, they're going to go to direct democracy, which means they're going to go to smartphones where citizens vote on ballot referendums and circumvent electors. So what I'm saying is they're going to have you vote on bills happening in front of Congress on your smartphone. Now, of course, there'll be no fraud. There'll be no shenanigans, no manipulation, and people will never vote for free money or for free stuff. That's where this is going.
Lorene Powell Jobs actually has some ownership over one of the apps that was used that botched the count for the Iowa election.
Yep.
You remember the Iowa caucuses where they got screwed up?
With Pete
and then
Robotron Buttigieg.
Yeah, Pete Buttigieg. I never stop at two. I always keep going. He was connected to business too. And that's why Mayor Cheat trended on Twitter. I guess at Jack doesn't like Pete very much to let that
thing
trend.
So we got to get to another question.
Sure.
My man, Dream City.
Hi, Alex. Can you pull up a little bit? My name is Sam. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Thrilled to be here.
This question's for my brother. He went up to Seattle after going to Walter Cronkite for 4 years, and he's turned to the dark side. So my question is just, it's going to be generic to wrap it up. During your time at Berkeley, or even prior to that, or even after that, what would you say was your major turning point in life? What was a time you had to sacrifice something you may have wanted to do with your heart or with your mind, but your heart was putting you elsewhere, you know? And
there's a couple
you're involved in now.
Yeah. Thank you. And for me, it was pretty easy transition. And the hardest stuff for me in my life has just been, because of how Breitbart is, everyone's always just come at us with pickaxes and torches, and not the tiki torches from Bed Bath & Beyond that the Charlottesville guys were using. This is the real deal. This is real stuff that people have come at us with, and the trebuchets with the fiery things to catapult. We've been up here a while. I'm starting to make silly jokes. No, but for me, my evolution as a conservative started with talk radio, as it did for so many people. I was very open-minded and had open-minded parents who were conservative, but they didn't indoctrinate me. They just had talk radio on, and I just found talk radio, Larry Elder and Dennis Prager and Rush and Michael Savage and Hannity, and all these guys were so good, and they were so smart, and they had so many arguments, Laura Ingraham. And these were the people who were on in the car for me while I was driving around, and I just found them so unbelievable. And by the way, many of those people have shown incredible support for the book, which is a really a thrill for me. And I've been in the business for 15 years. It's still exciting when those people take an interest because they're so smart and they're so culturally savvy. And I was just totally all in. And when I met Andrew, Andrew was an editor at the Drudge Report, and he was just had built this this small but mighty operation already, and it was really just him. And he said he was going to expand into original content. And I just signed the dotted line right away. I was still at Berkeley. But the hardest stuff for me was I was a baseball player growing up, and I wanted to play baseball. And when the Division I offers didn't come through from high school, which was a huge disappointment for me, and I got into Berkeley on academics, the biggest decision of my life was saying to some schools that were not Division I schools, I don't want to play baseball for you. I'm going to go to Berkeley, and I'm going to live amongst the institutional left. I'm going to go there, and I'm going to see what they got. I'm going to go to class with them. I'm going to study with them. I'm going to write reports with them. I'm going to work with them at a local sustainable organic restaurant, see what appetizers they enjoy. It's fried goat cheese, by the way. That is what the hippies like up there. It's delicious. You can't deny it. It's good. I'm going to come out totally educated. And because of that, I think that's helped me be very effective in my role at Breitbart, is that I understand who the opposition is ideologically. And I'm saying opposition. I'm not saying enemy. I had a caller on my radio show this morning who literally referred to me as the enemy. He was a left-wing guy who called in, and he had referred to me and sort of Trump's America. And I think in general, a lot of white people, I think he had some racial issues that he was working through, were the enemy. And it's like, I don't talk that way. They're ideological opponents. And a lot of them are very ignorant, and raising awareness is key. And you talk about school boards. It's the schools. It's the culture. It's the media. It's entertainment, less so these days, because entertainment classes really embarrass themselves so much that they're just kind of used for us to poke fun at them for being stupid. But these were the people who are guiding the culture. And I've been very blessed to live and work amongst them, which I think really helps us stay sharp and move on our toes at Breitbart. So I would say the biggest thing, saying goodbye to baseball and saying yes to Berkeley, for sure, that was the turning point for me when I really got into this.
Awesome. Well, Alex, you do amazing work at Breitbart. Alex is going to sign some books. I'll take pictures if anyone wants to do that really quick. And we'll just, if you guys want, if you care about getting critical race theory out of Arizona, Chandler, Arizona, Chandler Unified School Districts, June 9th, 6:30 p.m., they're trying to push critical race theory through Chandler. And so just want to make sure you guys are all aware of that. And it just so happens we have Freedom Square the night before. So we'll see what happens. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Email us your thoughts, freedom@charliekirk.com. And if you'd like to support this program, go to charliekirk.com/support. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. God bless.
For more on many of these stories and news you can trust, go to charliekirk.com.